I'm Ken Weinstein, President and CEO of Hudson Institute. Hudson was founded 51 years ago as a forward-looking policy research organization designed to think creatively about how to achieve a better future in the face of the then unprecedented challenges of the early 1960s. Though the world has changed in significant ways since those days, our fundamental ways of looking at the world have not. Since the founding days of Hudson Institute, our work has been shaped in part by the belief that the dedicated efforts of a few determined individuals can make a significant difference in the fight for freedom and human rights. And the book that we will be discussing today, Escape from North Korea, The Untold Story of Asia's Underground Railroad, embodies this concept. This highly anticipated volume by Hudson Institute Senior Fellow Melanie Kirkpatrick has just been published by Encounter Books. And I must say that Melanie offers both a very moving and a very analytic account of the experiences of North Koreans who risked their lives to escape the world's worst tyranny, as well as the networks of for-profit smugglers and humanitarian groups, primarily dedicated Christian missionaries and Korean Americans who helped them. Escape from North Korea also offers an original examination of the political climate of North Korea and recommends policies that may help bring down the totalitarian regime that rules Pyongyang. The book, which has already received very favorable reviews in Publishers Weekly, The Wall Street Journal, and The Weekly Standard, as well as in the South Korean press, is available for purchase at the discounted price of $20 after the event. And I urge all of you to get a copy of the book. Melanie Kirkpatrick herself is a frequent contributor to many prominent publications, including the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, for which she worked from 1980 to 2009. At The Wall Street Journal, she was deputy editor of the Mighty Editorial Page from 2006 to 2009 and a longtime member of the editorial board. And so she undoubtedly played a key role in shaping the thinking of many of us in this room. As deputy editor, she was responsible for the editorial page's coverage of international issues and oversaw the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal in Asia and in Europe, the Far Eastern Economic Review, as well as U.S. columnists on foreign affairs. My colleagues and I at Hudson are deeply proud to claim her as a colleague, and we look forward to her comments today as well. We're also very pleased to welcome Professor Jay Koo, the director of the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, as well as Greg Scarlaccio, the Executive Director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. We will also be hearing as well from Suzanne Schulte, Chair of the North Korea Freedom Coalition, as well as Kim Seung-min, North Korean defector and the founder of Free North Korea Radio, both of whom are coming to us from a meeting on Capitol Hill and have been delayed a few minutes. And we look forward to a compelling discussion between these experts. Lastly, let me remind you once again that copies of Escape from North Korea will be available for sale in our lobby at the discounted price of $20, and Melanie Kirkpatrick has graciously agreed to sign copies. I urge all of you to read it, discuss it, and read it again. And now let me turn it over to our to Melanie Kirkpatrick.
Right.
Okay, I'll start. Thank you all for being here today, and thank you, Ken, for that very warm introduction. I found a very congenial intellectual home here at the Hudson Institute, and I'd like to express my especially warm thanks to two senior fellows. One is Michael Horowitz, who I don't think is here today, but who is a very compassionate and long-term observer of human rights in North Korea. I thank him for his advice. And the other senior fellow I'd like to thank is Jack David, whom some of you may know has a second job as my husband, a more challenging one perhaps. but Jack was my first reader and I must say my toughest critic, and I thank him very much. I'm also very grateful to Greg and Jay for being here today and agreeing to discuss my book, and to Suzanne and Kim Seung-min, who I hope will be here very shortly. I thought I would begin by mentioning the exact moment that I became aware of the suffering of the North Korean people. That was in 1981, and I was the op-ed editor of the Asian Wall Street Journal in Hong Kong. One morning I went to the office, and there was a submission that crossed my desk from a journalist in working in Peking, as we called it then, who was Italian. And he had achieved the rare feat of obtaining a visa to Pyongyang. And he'd written an article about it for his magazine, and he sent me a translation of it, hoping that it would be published in the Asian Wall Street Journal. I published it, and it was an eye-opening article for me, especially his descriptions of the Kim family worship in Pyongyang. For me, it was like reading a chapter of 1984. George Orwell's dystopian vision had come to life in North Korea a few years early. I couldn't get the closing line out of my head, and I'll quote it here. He wrote, "When I got off the plane in Peking, I kissed the ground, happy to be back in a free country." China, 1981, a free country? I knew from personal experience that there was little freedom there. Was it really possible that North Korea could be worse? 30 years later, we of course know the answer to that question. North Korea is the world's most repressive regime. Its people are slaves of the Kim family regime, which controls every aspect of their life, including whether or not you get to eat. Religion is banned. There's no rule of law. Perceived political infractions are met with harsh punishment, punishment that is meted out to three generations of an offender's family in many cases. If a man or a woman commits a political crime, he knows that he will, when he goes to jail, his parents and his children will go with him. Most awful of all, we know about the Gulag, where at least a million people have perished, and there are now 200,000 people languishing there at this very moment. The reason we know all of this, and more, is thanks to the testimonies of the people I write about in my book, those who have escaped from North Korea. This knowledge comes to us despite nearly 60 years of isolation and the best efforts of the Kim family regime to keep it secret. For more than 50 years, North Korea has been sealed off from the rest of the world. To give just one example of how the Kim family keeps information out of North Korea and keeps us from getting information, every radio, even in one's own home, is required to be registered with the security police. That is, you have to take your radio when you purchase it to the police station and register it. At the same time, you are not allowed to change the dial, which is fixed to North Korea's government radio station. To enforce this rule, security police equipped with scanners will cruise neighborhoods trying to find households that are tuning into illegal foreign radio broadcasts, people who've tinkered with their radios. Surveys of North Koreans who've escaped to China and elsewhere show that a very high percentage of them had listened to these foreign radio broadcasts before they left North Korea, and their motivation to leave was at least in part informed by what they heard on those broadcasts and their knowledge of the opportunities outside their borders. I think it reinforces the idea that people in North Korea really are hungry for information. And I see people standing in the back. There's room in the front if you'd like to sit down. Please join us. As many of you know, North Koreans who decide to escape must first go to China. You can't go south to the DMZ, even though it is called the Demilitarized Zone. It's the world's most militarized border, and nobody can go across it without guidance. In China, the policy is to track down North Korean refugees, arrest them, and send them back to North Korea. This policy is both immoral, and it's in contravention of China's obligations under the international treaties it has signed. Some of the North Koreans in China, however, decide to risk a second escape. They get out of China. They want to go out of China to South Korea or, in some cases, other countries. But no one can accomplish this feat on their own. They need help. And here's where the new Underground Railroad comes into play. Like the original Underground Railroad in the American South prior to the Civil War, the new Underground Railroad is a network of safe houses and transit routes across China. And the operators are both human traffickers, that is, those people who are in it for the money, and Christians whose religious beliefs impel them to help their brothers and sisters in North Korea. Also, like the original Underground Railroad, where many of the operators were freed blacks, in China, many of the operators are ethnic Koreans. They are Korean Americans, or they are South Koreans, or in some cases, they are also ethnic Koreans who have Chinese citizenship. Thanks to the Underground Railroad across China, an increasing number of North Koreans have reached safety in recent years. The numbers are quite startling. In 1990, a total of 9 North Koreans got to South Korea. 9. 10 years later, about 100 got to South Korea. Last year, 2,737 North Koreans reached safety in South Korea. There's a total of about 24,000 North Koreans who are living in the South today. In addition to educating all of us about the truth of life in North Korea, the exiles are performing a second, perhaps even more important function. They are educating their countrymen. They are helping to open up their information-starved homeland. Just as the world today knows more about North Korea, North Koreans also know far more of the world. This is thanks in large part to the people who've escaped. How do they do this? It is impossible to make a phone call to North Korea or to send an email or a text message or even mail a letter. So the exiles have created a black market in information. They hire Chinese couriers to cross the border, knock on their relative's door, and hand-deliver a message. Sometimes they send money. Sometimes they send Chinese cell phones that they then ask the relative to use to receive a phone call from them. They capture the Chinese signal. And in South Korea, North Korean exiles like Kim Sung-ming, who will be here shortly, have formed organizations to help transmit information to North Korea in a more systematic way. There are 4 radio stations now run by defectors, including Kim Sung-ming, that broadcast to North Korea. And there are other organizations that are using high-tech, often digital means to get information into North Korea. To give you just one very small example of that, I know of one group that has DVDs on which it's put South Korean soap operas and other quote-unquote subversive information. And they get a Chinese courier to take that to a town in North Korea and just drop them off on a corner, hoping that somebody will pick them up, will steal them, and take it home and watch them. Because of all this, the mantra of the Kim family regime that North Korea is the greatest nation on earth is being exposed finally for the lie that it is. I'll point out that Kim Jong-un, the new dictator of South Korea, understands the power of information and the threat that it poses to his rule. One of his first acts after succeeding his father last December was to issue orders to guards along the border to shoot to kill anybody who was trying to cross the border. There are also reports that he has performed other crackdowns on the families of North Koreans who have escaped. He's very much trying to stop the information flow into North Korea. I'd like to close with a quote from a North Korean boy I interviewed. This is a boy who escaped to China when he was 13 years old. His family had all died or disappeared. He was alone. He crossed the border. When he got to China, he was fortunate to run into a Chinese Christian who suggested that he look for help at a church. And his reply was, "What's a church?" And the person told him, "Look for a building with a cross on it." He did that, and he eventually got out of China with the help of an American aid organization, Liberty in North Korea. And I heard him address in English, I might add, a group of people at Liberty in North Korea. And he said to them, "What you are doing changed my life, and it will eventually change North Korea." Today, thanks to the information from North Koreans who've escaped, it's no longer possible for anyone to plead ignorance about what's going on in North Korea. We know about the suffering of the North Korean people, the depredations of the totalitarian regime, and we can't argue that things really aren't so bad in that country. A free North Korea is not an impossible goal. With the help of the North Korean people themselves, those in exile, and those still locked in their prison state, we could make it happen.
Melanie, thank you very much for your presentation and for a book that... and for an extraordinary book that adds tremendously to the effort to bring more attention to the plight of North Korean refugees in China and beyond, and to the human rights violations being perpetrated by the North Korean regime. I would also like to mention that Melanie's husband, Jack David, is also a board member of our committee, the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, and I would also like to acknowledge the co-chair of our committee, Dr. Roberta Cohen, who is present today, and Mr. John Dupre, also a board member. For the past 9 months, since Kim Jong-il died, we have been faced with a charm offensive that a few days ago a North Korean scholar called a version of image first politics in North Korea. I've certainly seen the first lady of young first lady of North Korea being paraded before TV cameras. We've seen Mickey Mouse, and we have seen defectors and former Japanese chefs of Kim Jong-il being apparently magnanimously forgiven by the dear young leader of North Korea. From our viewpoint as human rights organizations, what we can say is that we have seen no evidence that the human rights situation in North Korea has improved. And Melanie's work and Melanie's book helps everyone remember the terrible plight of North Korean refugees trying to escape an extraordinarily oppressive regime. This book helps us remember that they face forcible repatriation by China in violation of the 1951 Refugee Convention, forcible repatriation that often results in extraordinarily cruel punishment, imprisonment in North Korea's cruel political prison camps, where between 150 and 200,000 people are still being imprisoned. I would now like to turn the floor over to our discussant, Dr. Che Gu, who is the director of the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins SAIS. He is also a professional lecturer. He was a director of human rights for the North Korea Project at Freedom House. He has taught at Brown University, Yonsei University, and also at Sungmyung Women's University in Seoul. He is a recipient of Fulbright and Freeman Fellowships. He has conducted research at various think tanks, including the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Korean Institute of International Studies in Seoul, and the Institute for International Relations in Hanoi. He holds a PhD in international relations from SAIS. Dr. Che Gu has asked me to keep his introduction short, although there's so much to say about him. Dr. Gu, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. Thank you, Hudson Institute, for hosting this event, and thank you, Melanie, for writing a wonderful book, a much-needed book. Once Suzanne and Kim Seung-min get here, it will be a sort of a reunion for me. Before I went back to Johns Hopkins, I ran the North Korea Human Rights Project at Freedom House. I was the first and only director under the 2004 North Korea Human Rights Act to have a project at Freedom House to work for human rights advocacy there. I think if you're going to read one book on North Korea this year, I think this is it. Melanie has written a very readable book, a very readable but a critical account of what is really happening in North Korea now and what has happened in North Korea in the past two decades. I think the book's contribution is twofold. It is for people like me who cover Korean issues every day, not always about North Korea, not always about human rights, but to get a better understanding of what North Korea is undergoing, why we have 20 to 25,000 North Korean defectors in Korea, South Korea at all. How did at some point 300,000 or even 500,000 North Koreans living in China, but only 20, 25,000 end up in South Korea? And she really delves into the kind of problems that these defectors have in North Korea. Too often in this town, we kind of see these issues in bigger picture. Yes, they're being repatriated from by China. Yes, they're trafficked. But we don't really understand the kind of the stories behind these statistics. And I think that's her contribution. And it's also a contribution, I would think, for many of you who know something about North Korea, and you've read the articles in the newspapers, seen the news events, the goose-stepping North Korean soldiers in the square, their pursuit of nuclear weapons, but not really fully grasping what's happening internally in North Korea and how that's affecting the relations with the outside world. And so I think the second fold, it's a useful book to provide the kind of the general information for people who don't cover or really know a whole lot about North Korea. Before I go further into commenting about this book, I should say what this book is not about. And I'm very glad it's not about this. It's not about how North Korea got the bomb or why it got the bomb or the tedious negotiations behind trying to get the North Korea to denuclearize series that has yet to bear any fruit conclusion. But it is a comprehensive treatment of how North Korean citizens flee and the people who really help them. And she humanizes these individuals by weaving their personal stories and weaving the personal stories of the people who help them get out. And as she does this, in doing so, she really touches very seriously about the issues that we deal with North Korea every day, the recurring famine, the cruelty, the inability of the regime to feed itself, and its treatment of its own citizens, and also the biggest problem facing defectors as they escape North Korea, is how do they endure and survive in China? What kind of obstacles are they going through? In the human rights community, we often talk about North Korean women who get to Seoul, and they say the price to pay, and it's somehow recognize and accept it that this is the minimal payment. This is the price you have to pay to get freedom, which is you have to be trafficked. And not enough of us in this audience or in elsewhere really understand that that's the price for those women who've made it out. And as they begin to get maybe their daughters or their sisters, they recognize that that's the experience that they too must undergo. And I think what Melanie does is to capture that horrifying story behind all of these people. Too often we get caught up in numbers. In this town, I've sat on many of these panels discussing whether is it 500,000 who died from famine? Is it 1 million? Is it 2 million? Is it 300,000 North Koreans in China or 500,000? And as we discuss these statistics, we really lose sight of the individuals behind these figures. I mean, if you were North Koreans and you somehow witnessed your father, mother, siblings starve to death, can't find the next meal, not for the next day or two, but months at a time, and you've been conditioned to live in that totalitarian state and somehow you find the courage to somehow say, I cannot live here. And you make that bold, courageous move to cross that border. And you don't have the world life knowledge about use of currency or foreign language or how to live in a foreign society. And so every time you cross into a border, you're not sure if that the border guards will require a bribe payment or will shoot you. And if you find someone who can help, as Melanie writes about this young man who looked for a cross, how do you trust that person? And as Melanie documents how they go from one Underground Railroad station to the next, you're really reliving that insecurity, that fear. Is this person going to sell me out? How do I trust this person? And this process gets replayed every time you cross a border. Unless you somehow manage to find or buy a fake passport, maybe get on a flight to Seoul directly from Beijing or elsewhere, you really have to make at least two border crossings into China, into Mongolia maybe, into Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Myanmar. So at some point, you might be making border crossings of 3-4 countries. And what kind of emotions do they go through? Once they go through this human, this tragic hell, really hell on earth, they somehow make it to South Korea. Few of them, I think maybe 100, maybe 10, 15 more have made it to the United States. They're the lucky ones, and yet they have to go through the guilt of putting their loved ones in vulnerable position in North Korea, in which regime will probably have made some kind of committed retribution against the family, or even the guilt of how come I survived? How did I make it when my sister didn't? Or how did I make it when my friend did not? And I want to conclude with the one of the lucky stories that Melanie mentioned. This young man now, but he was a boy of 13 when he crossed the border. I got to know him because soon as he came and was, settled in Richmond, my friend who was with the organization, American Aid Organization, brought him, and I was teaching a class on North Korea human rights. And he came and he spoke about what his existence was like, how he hid out in China, how he, scrounged for food, begged for food, stole food, and how he managed with the help of an American organization. Now, when you think of American organization, you think of people like, us, late, mid, 40s, 50s, these were really college kids. Kids who, they were really kids. They were young, idealistic, bright, early 20-something kids who went out there and said, after college, I want to make a difference. And they were able to get at least this young boy out, and he came to my class. And he's telling my class how every day he would get up and start reading. And he would read literally several books a day because he would read until nightfall. And my friend says, ask him what he has in his pocket. And I said, why? He said, because he had strawberries this morning, and I think he still has some in his pocket. And here's a guy, young, vibrant, energetic, optimistic. And I think his story is a testament to what North Korean defectors have experienced and hopefully are enjoying their lives in South Korea and elsewhere. Thank you very much.
Dr. Koo, thank you very much. We are now being joined by Suzanne Schulte and Kim Sung-min, our two other discussants. Our greatest challenges are that it's always hard to maintain North Korea at the top of the agenda, and it's particularly hard to maintain human rights at the top of the agenda. I think that we're very fortunate that as we are featuring such a unique book addressing the fate of North Korean refugees and North Korean human rights, two of our discussants are held back at a hearing on the Hill addressing North Korean human rights, and I hope that the human rights community here continues to stay as busy as it is today. I am now going to turn the floor over to our next speaker, Mr. Kim Song-min, who comes from a military background, and I know that he's always ready to execute right away. So he's a former captain, actually, in the North Korean Army. He's a winner of the Reporters Without Borders Media Award and the Asia Democracy and Human Rights Award, and he's also well known for being the founder and director of Free North Korea Radio. He escaped from North Korea, was arrested in China, and then subsequently repatriated. Because he had served as a captain in the North Korean military, he was subjected to execution. He faced imminent death. He narrowly escaped by jumping from a moving train. And after eventually escaping to South Korea, he has become one of the most active leaders of among North Korean defectors, having served as the chairman of the North Korean Defectors Association and also as chair of the annual North Korea Freedom Week since the event was moved to Seoul in 2010. Mr. Henry Song will be Mr. Kim Song-min's interpreter, although I suspect that his English is great. He's still reluctant to speak English. I hope that will happen at future events. Mr. Kim, the floor is yours.
Hello, welcome everyone. And it seems like there are more faces that I recognize here than new faces here. So thank you.
밀라니 선생이 책 썼다는 소리 서울에서 듣고요. 진짜 보고 싶어 죽겠는데 그 내 영어를 몰라서.
And I also want to point out that Mr. Fox, a longtime friend, is here also. And when I was in Korea, I heard that Miss Melanie Kirkpatrick wrote this book, and I want to read this so badly, but my English, my poor English skills will not allow me to read this book right away.
Hopefully, we'll have a Korean version one day.
감사합니다. 저보다 앞뒤가 좀 늦었지만 구제희 박사님이 그 탈북자들의 삶에 대해서 말씀하시는 거 제가 들었고요. 평소부터 구 박사님은 탈북자들에 대해서 너무 잘 알고 있는 분이기 때문에 제가 특별히 할 이야기가 있을까 지금 고민스럽습니다.
And I arrived a bit late, and I did hear Dr. Koo talk a little bit about the North Korean refugees and defectors, and he is someone who cares very deeply about the North Korean refugees and defectors, and very well aware of the situation regarding them. And I'm a bit concerned that he, since he spoke, I don't really don't know what I should talk about here.
그 우리 메라니 선생이 탈북자의 삶을 그린 책을 썼다 그래서 정말 궁금합니다. 솔직히 어떤 내용이 담겼을까가 먼저 궁금한데 일단 후에 한국판이 나온다니까 그때 꼭 보기로 하고 제가 그 아주 오래 전에 우리 메라니 선생한테 들려줬던 탈북자의 시 한 편 짧은 거 한번 읊어드릴까 합니다.
And regarding Ms. Kirkpatrick's book, since it is about the North Korean refugees, truthfully speaking, I really wonder what it's about, the contents of the book. So I will make sure to read it when it does come out in the Korean language. And I would like to recite a poem that I recited to Ms. Kirkpatrick a long time ago right now.
제목은 고백이고요.
And the title is Confession.
떠나던 나를 위해 아무도 울어준 이 없는 것이 고향입니다.
My hometown is a place where when I left, nobody wept for me.
하지만 그곳은 내가 나서 첫 걸음 익힌 곳, 못다한 나의 사랑일 수 있습니다.
However, that place where I took my first steps perhaps is the place where my love is.
끝입니다.
Oh, that's it.
우리 탈북자들이 고향을 떠날 때 정말 고향만 떠나는 게 아니라 지금껏 살아온 자신들의 모든 것을 놓고 오고 있습니다.
And when North Koreans leave North Korea, they do not only leave their hometown or where they were born, but they're leaving behind everything.
사랑하는 사람들, 내가 배웠던 모든 것, 그리고 내가 누렸던 삶 전체를 놓고 오는 슬픔을 겪는 것이 탈북자들입니다.
It's a life where it's a situation where the North Koreans leave their loved ones, everything that they know and learned about, and it's a very sad situation when they leave North Korea.
그런 아픔에 비해서 어떻게 보면 몽골로 그 박사님 아까 말씀하셨지만 몽골로 베트남으로 캄보디아로 혹은 중국에서 그 탈북자의 삶 이런 것들은 어떻게 보면 그 고향을 떠날 때 아픔보다 덜 아픈 걸 수도 있죠.
And I could almost say that compared to the pain of actually leaving North Korea, the experience of actually going to Mongolia or, as Dr. Koo mentioned, other countries such as Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, I think leaving Korea itself is far more painful and more miserable than going to these countries.
제 이야기도 말씀 앞에서 나왔기 때문에 그냥 짧게 말씀드리면 중국에서의 3년 동안 탈북자 생활 그리고 밀선을 타려고 했다가 다시 북한으로 적세를 차고 끌려가던 그 뭐 아픔 그리고 다시 또 이제 중국 대륙을 횡단하던 뭐 그런 육체적인 그리고 환경 이런 것보다도 지금도 저한테 아픈 것은 내가 떠나던 고향, 고향과 그 헤어지던 그 순간 그게 지금도 아픔으로 남아 있습니다.
Regarding my life, I know it was briefly talked about before we came, but I lived for 3 years in China as a refugee. And my attempt to flee China for freedom on a ship was foiled, and I was arrested and led away in handcuffs. And more so than the physical aspect of leaving, for me right now, even to this day, it's the emotional and the pain that I feel in my heart that I experience when I remember the separation, that feeling of separation that I went through.
좀 슬픈 이야기지만 여기 우리 탈북자가 2만 4천 명이라고 하고 있는데 그보다 훨씬 더 많은 수가 자유를 찾지 못하고 중국에서 혹은 몽골리아에서 죽지 않았나 그런 아픈 마음도 늘 가지고 있습니다.
And I also have a sad heart regarding the North Korean refugees. More than the number 24,000 who have resettled in South Korea, a bigger number than that have died trying to reach freedom, whether that's in China or in Mongolia.
어떤 영화의 줄거리가 된 이야기인데요. 탈북자 9명이 몽골의 그 사막을 8일 동안 오다가 모두 지쳐가지고 11살짜리 어린애가 따라서지 못하는 걸 알면서도 저들도 죽을 수 있기 때문에 계속 끝까지 왔다는 이야기가 있습니다. 그리고 그 아이는 혼자 몽골 사막에서 죽었고 그 아이의 아빠는 그 아이의 시체라도 찾아오겠다고 몽골 대통령에게 19번 편지를 써서 4년 후에 국경으로 가서 A 죽음을 아들의 죽음을 가져왔던 그런 이야기가 있습니다.
And there's a certain motion picture film. The plot is based on a real life story that happened whereby 9 North Korean defectors, they were wandering the Mongolian desert searching for a way out to freedom. And among the 9 was an 11-year-old boy. And this boy ended up dying in the desert. And the father of the 11-year-old boy that died pleaded with the Mongolian president, wrote him 19 letters to at least bring back the body of his son from the desert. And that was finally realized after many attempts to do so.
북한을 떠나서 중국 대륙을 횡단해서 몽골과는 조금 다른 방향, 이를테면 베트남으로 가는 방향, 탈북 루트가 또 하나 있죠. 그 탈북...
And there's another route when North Koreans leave North Korea, besides going through China and then onto Mongolia, and that route is going to Vietnam.
쿤밍이라는 중국의 끝점, 그리고 거기서 지나가면 베트남이 되고 그 긴 베트남을 떠나서 횡단하면 캄보디아가 됩니다. 그 베트남과 캄보디아를 가르는 약 10m 폭 10m밖에 안 되는 그 물길이 쫙 되어 있습니다. 서해 국경을 표하는.
And from the southernmost city in China, Kunming, which is right near Vietnam, and then going through the slender country, the geographically slender country of Vietnam, which leads to Cambodia. Between the Cambodian and Vietnam border, there is a riverway or waterway that is a very short distance of only 10 meters that separates the two countries.
북한에서 그 베트남까지 거리가 약 4,000km가 되는데요. 탈북자들은 그 4,000km까지 뒤 한 번 돌아보지 못하고 계속 갑니다. 삶을 찾아서. 거기서 10m의 국경을 지나면 서히 마음을 넣을 수 있는 캄보디아가 눈앞에 있습니다.
North Koreans, when they leave North Korea, the refugees, when they travel to Vietnam, the total distance is about 4,000 kilometers. And once they start on this journey, they cannot look back because they are searching, going on this journey for better life. And only when they cross that 10-meter wide river between Cambodia and Vietnam, once they are in Cambodia, can they rest at ease and actually feel safe.
9일을 9명의 탈북자가 갔던 적이 있어요. 우리 자유북한 방송국에 나는 중국에서 사는 누군데 도와달라. 그래서 방송국에서 그렇게 워낙 방송이 어렵기 때문에 탈북자까지 도와주는 것 정말 참 어려운 일이지만 우리 자유북한 방송국 원칙은 전화 걸려온 사람은 무조건 데려온다라는 원칙이 있었기 때문에 약 500명 정도의 탈북자들이 우리의 소개를 받고 왔는데 그중에 9명 정도가 이제 떠났던 적이 있어요. 바로 그 4,000km를.
And that 4,000 km route from North Korea through to Vietnam. At one point, there were 9 North Korean refugees that traveled this route. And one of the defectors, that refugees that was part of this group, actually called our radio station, Free North Korea Radio, asking for help, telling us that, listen, we are refugees in China. We want to go on this route, so please help us. And at that time, our radio station was in a very difficult situation. But I considered our principle that we will help whoever calls our station. So far we've had about 500 people, 500 North Korean refugees contact our station requesting for help.
그 가운데 그 9명 중에 LA의 그 대표적인 한인교회인 베델 한인교회의 선인식이라는 목사님이 저에게 이제 부탁했던 21살짜리 여자애가 있었어요. 얘가 중국에서 어떻게 연락이 와서 나한테까지 연락이 왔는데 당신 내가 좀 도와줄 수 없냐 그래서 얼마든지 해서 암명제에 끼어서 지금 도착했던 순간.
And among the nine, there was a young 21-year-old North Korean defector woman who sought help from a well-known Korean-American megachurch pastor in LA, Pastor Peter Son of Irvine Bethel Church, and it was requested that we help this woman as well.
근데 그 도착했던 날이 마침 그 전날에 비가 와가지고 10m 폭, 높이는 거의 2m밖에 안 되는 그 수로에 물이 조금 더 불었답니다. 비가 와가지고. 그래서 안내하는 사람이 이거 오늘은 못 건너가겠다. 돌아서자. 라고 했는데, 돌아서자고 했는데 이 친구가 돌아를 못 서고 전화가 왔어요. 무조건 오늘 건너가야 되겠다. 눈앞에 자유가 있는데 왜 말리느냐. 그래서 거기 안내하던 친구가 그럼 건너가자 하고 9명을 다 수용할 줄 아냐 수용할 줄 안다고 했는데 다 건너가 보니까 그 친구 하나만 없더랍니다.
And the day when they arrived, the group arrived at the riverbank to cross the 10-meter wide river between Cambodia and Vietnam. It was raining a lot at that time, so it was a little bit deeper than usual. And the guide said, we cannot cross, we must turn back. But that young woman said, no, the freedom is right before our eyes, we must cross the river. So the guide asked them, do all of you know how to swim? And they replied, yes. But when they crossed the river, they found out that woman was the only one who didn't make it across.
그렇게 죽어간, 이름 없이 죽어간, 그 2m밖에 안 되는 물에 빠져 죽어간, 그리고 사막에서 죽어간, 그리고 우리가 알지 못하게 죽어간 탈북자들이 얼마일까 그런 생각을 늘 하면서 오늘을 우리들은 행복을 살고 있습니다.
And that nameless young woman who perished in only 2 meter deep water, and other defectors who perished in the desert and who perished in other ways, we wonder how many more out there died the silent, nameless deaths, and we wonder about that while we are here living in comfort and safety.
그렇게 우리가 그 표현을 못하는 말로 다 표현 못하는 그런 탈북 스토리, 탈북 내용들이 정말 얼마나 많은지요. 생각하고 하다가 우리 탈북자들이 십시일반으로 돈을 모아서 이름하여 탈북 스토리를 담은 북한과 중국 그 48 최단 거리 48m에서 벌어지는 탈북 스토리를 담은 영화 48m라는 것을 만들었습니다. 그리고 여기에 워싱턴에 가지고 왔습니다.
And we thought about these North Koreans who died these miserable deaths, and we thought about how many more out there like this suffer like this, and we thought about it. We came together and we decided that we will pool our own money, our own resources, and we will make a movie that highlights the stories, the real life stories of these defectors, what they go through when they leave North Korea. And we specifically pinpointed the region between North Korea and China. In the Yalu River, the distance is only 48 meters, and we titled this movie 48M, 48 meters, and this is the film that we brought to Washington D.C.
그 꼭 관심 가지시고 탈 그 봐주시기를 부탁드리겠고요. 그리고 제가 그 보스로서 우리 멜라니 선생한테 부탁드리고 싶은데 그 그 좋은 필력으로 우리 영화 한번 소개해 주세요.
And please show great interest in that film and view the screening which will be held tonight. And I would just like to end my statement by asking Ms. Kirkpatrick, please use the power of your mighty pen and let's promote our film. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Kim Song-min, thank you for your courage and your relentless efforts. Our next discussant is a true force of nature. She has been the driving force behind the North Korean human rights movement for so many years. Suzanne Scholte, president of the Defense Forum Foundation, a nonprofit educational foundation tasked to sponsor programs on Capitol Hill addressing foreign policy, defense, and human rights. She's also co-vice chair of our own committee on human rights in North Korea. 15 years ago, she was the first one to bring here to Washington, D.C., two well-known North Korean defectors who were given an opportunity to speak, Colonel Jeju-hwal and a former senior diplomat, Mr. Ko Yong-hwan, who also happens to be here today in the audience. We're very glad he has been able to join us. And so many other well-known names, Kang Chol-hwan, author of The Aquariums of Pyongyang, a book that brought so much attention to North Korean human rights. Over 38 North Korean defectors have visited the United States, often on multiple occasions, and all owing to Suzanne Scholte's relentless efforts. Without further ado, Suzanne, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I do apologize profusely that Kim Song-min and I were late, but part of the reason why we were late, because the question came up in the congressional hearing, is why aren't people paying attention to the North Korea? You know, North Korea is the worst human rights tragedy. Why aren't people paying attention? And I just want to start by thanking Melanie Kirkpatrick. I can say I have been involved in this issue since 1996. Few journalists have done what she has done in trying to get these issues out and written about this issue consistently. Now more and more people are paying attention, but it was really Melanie that was using the power of the pen to write about these issues. So we're deeply grateful to her for that from the activist community. I think on behalf of the North Korean defectors, I say, we approve this message. But I want to make a couple of quick points because I know we need to have time for questions. But first of all, regarding China and then regarding U.S. policy. Regarding China, the government of China is directly responsible for the horrific conditions that are happening to these refugees by not recognizing them as refugees and calling them economic migrants, which continues to do, even though the moment they cross the border, and I'm sure you mentioned this during the discussion, even though the moment they cross the border, they fit the definition of refugees, because if they're sent back, they will most certainly be tortured, most certainly be imprisoned, in some cases executed for the crime of leaving their homeland. China knows this, and they cannot hide behind this claim because we have the evidence that when they do arrest these refugees, that they're literally marking them for death, because when they interview the refugees and they're finding out they're trying to go to South Korea or whether they were just trying to work in China to get money for their families, they're marking the papers, the interrogation papers, and handing this over to the North Koreans so the North Koreans know which ones were trying to come to South Korea, which means they're marking them for death because when they repatriate them, they know they'll be executed. But in addition, the environment in China, by having this repatriation policy, has created this lawless environment where you have over 80% of North Korean women being trafficked. There are markets where North Korean women are being bought and sold. And this is what Laura Ling and Ona Lee were trying to expose. That was why they were in China. They were trying to get the story out.
And you all know what happened to them. They ended up in Pyongyang, and Bill Clinton had to rescue them. But that's why they went to China. They wanted to expose the trafficking of North Korean women. This is an embarrassment to China. It's why they work so hard to prevent people from exposing what they're doing to these refugees. It's a situation where you have children that not only have no access to medical care or health care, these are orphans that are in China, but they can't even go outside to play for fear that they may be arrested and sent back to North Korea. So it's a horrific problem. Now, in addition to that, you've had Americans, Japanese, Chinese, South Koreans in prison, as Melanie has pointed out in her book and a story particularly about Steve Kim, had them been in prison in China because they were helping refugees. And most recently, the South Korean citizen Kim Yong-hwan was imprisoned and tortured because he was caught trying to help refugees. While last year, a South Korean missionary named Kim Chang-won was murdered by North Korean agents. And another, Kang Ho-bin, survived an assassination attempt but was killed in May of this year in a very suspicious car crash. Now, how ironic is it that China, that wants to be seen as a world leader, how ironic is it that they allow North Korean assassins to roam freely in their country, but will not allow the UNHCR access to these refugees? The other problem that I see that we've had is that our country has not been leaders on this issue. The United States has failed to lead on this issue. We've only seen a handful, 150 refugees, nothing, that have been able to make it to the United States. We have been reactive, not proactive. We only react when refugees try to seek asylum, but we do nothing to try to help them. And despite the U.S. Congress, which has three times passed a North Korea Human Rights Act, showing clearly their intent for the U.S. to do more to help refugees, there's only been a small number that have been able to make it here. I also believe, and I think that Melanie's absolutely right in some of the comments she makes about China in this book. I do absolutely believe that there is a case to be made that we can convince China that it is in their best interest to change their policy. It is in China's best interest for reform to come to North Korea, but they are creating a situation by really letting the regime off the hook by forcing the refugees back, which relieves any pressure on this regime to establish any kind of reforms because they force these refugees back. I also believe that the problem we have is that we have to remember that the Communist Party is in charge of China, and they want to continue to coddle this dictatorship, whereas the reformers in China know that if reform comes to North Korea, and it's inevitable that this regime is going to collapse, the defectors are predicting now it's going to be within the next 3 years, that it's actually in China's best interest to have a unified Korea that could be an economic partner with China, and it would actually benefit China economically. But, of course, the communist dictatorship doesn't want to have that partnership because they fear that. But the reformers in China know that that would actually be in China's best interest rather than constantly trying to bail out North Korea and continue to coddle this dictator. The other point I want to make, too, is that we hear this repeatedly, and Kim Sung-min eloquently dramatized this in his poem. North Koreans don't want to leave North Korea. They leave North Korea because they feel they have no choice. And if you talk to the defectors in South Korea, they all want to go back to their homeland and build it into a democracy that has human rights like they've seen and lived under in South Korea. So finally, I just want to say another point is that this is a unique refugee situation. It could be solved overnight because North Korean refugees are the only refugees in the world that have an immediate place for resettlement. They're unique in that they have that. They're citizens of South Korea under the South Korean Constitution. And I just want to conclude by one point that I want to make is that we have plenty of Harriet Tubmans, as Melanie Kirkpatrick has pointed out in her book. We have plenty of people that are willing to risk their lives to help these refugees, but we have no Raoul Wallenbergs. We haven't found a diplomat yet that's willing to stick their neck out to really get involved in helping these refugees. And yet we know that our government, our Congress, very much wants us to do more. So with that, I want to just conclude, but I just want to say that, Melanie, thank you so much for the amazing effort that you've done in this pen and spending the last 2 years doing this book. I'm just so grateful to you.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. Before we proceed with a brief Q&A, I would also like to say that in addition to Mr. Kim Song-min and Mr. Ko Yong-hwan, there are three other North Korean defectors who have joined us today. We are absolutely delighted that they have attended their program. We welcome their presence, and we thank them for their courage and everything they do for a good cause. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now ready to proceed with a brief Q&A. I would like to ask that you wait for the mic before you ask your question. We are live streaming this program. If possible, I would also like you to mention your name and, if possible, your affiliation, and keep your questions as brief as possible. Yes, sir.
Doug Feith of the Hudson Institute. The U.S. government has debated the provision of food aid to North Korea, and I'd be interested in your comments on how can the food aid, how should the food aid issue be looked at? Is it propping up the regime? Is it doing good? Is there an opportunity for leverage? What's your evaluation of how the U.S. government has done in using that leverage?
I'll quickly answer that, and maybe somebody else would like to add to it. But I've reluctantly come to the conclusion that food aid is propping up the Kim family regime, and that we should not provide food aid. Unless in the extremely remote case that our very reasonable conditions are met, such as allowing us to follow where the aid goes and check up on it. But I'll tell you, I interviewed a number of rescuers, people who help North Koreans, who came to the decision to help people get out of China and reach South Korea or the United States or elsewhere. They came to that decision because they had spent years trying to help inside North Korea. And it was a failure.
Yeah, if it's okay, I totally agree with what Melanie has said. The only way that I would give aid to North Korea is if we can see it to the point of consumption. If we don't see it to the point of consumption, it is diverted. And what will be diverted is anything that can possibly help the regime or the elites. And this is why you saw over the years, like Action Against Hunger, Doctors Without Borders, these wonderful humanitarian groups that left in protest because they saw their aid showing up in the markets in Pyongyang. And we've heard these stories again and again and again. And Greg had introduced Ko Yong-hwan. I wanted to mention, when Ko Yong-hwan first came to Washington in 1997, he came with a Colonel Jae-ju Chol. And I remember them, they stood up in front of an audience in Capitol Hill. This was in 1997. And they said, look at us. We are the living proof that your food aid is being diverted. Because the colonel in the army looked very, very healthy and was obviously extremely well fed, whereas Ko Yong-hwan was a little bit skinnier. And he said, now, after us, they don't get anything because they were part of the elites. And Colonel Jae-ju Chol told us the story. He says, I was in the military. The food aid trucks would come in. They would deliver the aid. They would have the family sign, you know, the Kim family got this much rice. The Lee family got this much rice. And as soon as those trucks left, the army came in and took all of that, the food back. And this is the story that we hear again and again and again repeatedly. So I would actually send a message to the North Korean people that we want to feed you. We have sent billions and billions of dollars. No one should have starved during the famine when 3 million people died. We provided enough aid from the international community, the United States of America. No one should have starved. We want to do that again. But we want to be sure that you get it. And I think we need to send a message to that effect.
We will take that question in the back next.
Stuart Reuter. Two questions in essence. What does South Korea do to vet the incoming defectors? Because that seems like a wonderful way to sneak in an agent provocateur. And the other would be, is there no sea route for escape, a la the Cuban defectors, since you have two coastlines, and there has to be some boats.
Sorry, sir, what was the second part of your question, sir?
Escaping by sea.
Is there not a sea route for escape down the coasts?
Well, I'll answer briefly, and anybody else can as well. A few defectors have reached South Korea via sea, but it's very difficult to get a boat. Boats are controlled by the government. That's one problem, and you have to get through patrols, and so it has not been a successful route so far. And the first question was vetting. Yes, the South Korean government vets every North Korean who reaches South Korea. The first stop for a refugee is the National Security Agency, where he'll be for several weeks or several months, depending upon how deep the debriefing is. Even so, North Korean agents have slipped through. And there have been successful assassinations of prominent North Korean defectors in South Korea by North Korean agents, and there have been assassination attempts. And I might say that Kim Sung-min has personally been the victim of some of this. He has to have a bodyguard because of the possible attacks on his own life. Maybe he'd like to say a word or two about that.
이런 내용 책에도 안 썼나요? 다 말씀하시는 거 쓴 것 같은데.
You didn't mention this in the book. It seems like you would have written about it in the book.
No, I didn't mention. Well, I mentioned it in passing, but not specifically your case.
그 탈북자가 해마다 2001년부터 해마다 2천 명 이상씩 옵니다.
In South Korea, starting from 2001, on a yearly basis, about 2,000 North Koreans have entered South Korea.
우리 고영환 선생이랑 올 때, 그러니까 그때 전에도 온 사람들이 있고, 80년대, 90년대 초반까지만 할 때는 1년에 10명도 안 왔습니다.
In the case of Mr. Ko Young-hwan and some of the earlier North Koreans who defected in the late 80s or early 90s, during that period, it was about 10 North Koreans who came on a yearly basis.
탈북자가 늘어나면 늘어날수록 그 속에 서해 북한 당국이 말하는 간첩을 끼워올 확률은 더 많겠죠, 아마.
And of course, as the number of the North Koreans who came as defectors increased, obviously the regime would want to use that and insert agents or try to send spies through the fake defection.
그만큼 또 탈북자들을 조사하는 국가정보원의 조사관들의 그 방법도 다양해지고 여러 가지로 그런 조건들을 막아놓기 때문에 사실 그 사이에 간첩이 끼어들기는 쉽지 않을 것 같습니다.
And of course, the South Korean National Intelligence Service and other law enforcement and intelligence services, they have a variety of methods to make sure that they catch these fake defectors and these spies, and they have measures set in place. So I believe that it would be extremely difficult for North Korea to successfully send spies as a fake defectors.
그래도 있다. 이것이 저희 대답이고요. 작지만 있다. 이것이 저희 대답이고 김정은이는 북한은 계속 끼어올 것이다. 또 이것 저희 대답입니다.
But my answer is that it does happen and Kim Jong-un will continue to use the defector coming into South Korea as a means to send spies to South Korea.
바다로 나오는 탈북자들은 의외로 많습니다. 해마다 약 20명, 어떤 해에는 최근에, 어떤 해는 30명도 됩니다. 근데 언론에는 잘 공개되지 않고 있고요. 계속 늘고 있을 거라고 생각합니다.
And regarding escape by the sea route, there have been at least 20 every year that escape North Korea via boats through the ocean. And most recently, there were 30 North Koreans who escaped by boat via the ocean. And this wasn't really reported in the media, but I believe that escape and defection by boat through the ocean will increase in the future.
I would also like to add, while there are these fake defections agents, but it's not altogether clear that any of the crimes committed on South Korean citizens and defectors were done by North Korean agents that came as defectors. It's easy for North Korean agents to infiltrate into South Korea. Not in addition to that, there are 70,000, 80,000 or more South Korean citizens who are sympathizers of North Korean state, that they hold allegiance to North Korea. So that threat that there would be sleeper cell agent from the defectors, I think is minimal. The real concern is not so much them, but the actual agents that somehow get into the South, into South Korea, and also sleeper cells of South Korean citizens.
We will take the question in front and then the question from Claire Hubbard in the second row.
My question will be for Ms. Melanie Kirkpatrick.
그 책을 출판한 데 대해서 진심으로 축하드립니다.
I want to congratulate you on the publication of your book.
책이 한국에서뿐만이 아니고 좀 북한에서도 번역이 돼서 좀 나왔으면 좋겠습니다.
And my wish is that not only in South Korea, but that the book will be translated in Korean and published in North Korea as well.
저는 그 여사님에게 그 뭐 근본적으로 돌아간다고 하면은 그 책을 처음에 이 쓰게 된 동기 그리고 북한에 대해서 처음 접해서 생각했을 때 그때에 대한 동기 부여가 어떤 데서부터 시작됐는지 그거에 대해서 좀 첫 번째로 궁금하고요. 두 번째는 지금 현재 그 북한이 지금 현재 처하고 있는 그 문제 말하자면 지금 현재 김정은 체제에 대한 그 북한에 대한 체제에 대한 그 멜라니 여사가 보는 입장 그리고 일단 그 부분하고 그 이제 탈북자 문제에 대해서 이제 탈북 북송 문제에 대해서 가지고 있는 개인적인 생각에 대해서 좀 듣고 싶다고 저는 저 북에서 온 탈북자라고 얘기를 해주시고 안혁이라고 합니다.
My name is An Hyuk, and as a North Korean defector, my question, two-part questions to Ms. Kirkpatrick. First one is, what motivated you to write this book? What made you write this book? And when you first heard about the situation in North Korea, what were your first thoughts that ran through your mind when you read about what was happening in North Korea? The second question is regarding the current situation in North Korea, issue of Kim Jong-un and his rule, his regime. That's one of the major topics, and Mr. An would like to know your views, personal views on that, and also your personal views on China's forced repatriation of North Korean defectors.
Thank you very much. And for a North Korean edition of my book, I would be very happy to waive any copyright rights that I have.
We can balloon launch it in. So.
I hope somebody can interpret for him. Thank you. To answer your question about my motivation, when I worked for the Wall Street Journal, I covered many issues in Korea, politics, foreign policy, and of course in North Korea, the nuclear issue. But in the late 90s and early 2000s, thanks to Suzanne Scholte, to Michael Horowitz here at Hudson, and to, well, I guess really to those two people, I began to hear about the crisis of human rights in North Korea and the people who left. That story captured my heart, and because I was senior enough at the Wall Street Journal by that point, I was able to follow that story with the support of my editor. On your question about Kim Jong-un and also about China, I would say that all the talk of the possibility of reform under Kim Jong-un makes me very skeptical because I have heard reports from people along the border about his orders to crack down on North Korean refugees. And I believe his actions speak louder than any PR efforts he's making in Pyongyang to make us think that he has other plans in mind for his country. And China's, I write a lot about China's treatment of refugees in my book. Much of my book is about that. And I think China should be publicly shamed about its treatment of refugees. And I also believe that the world should offer to help China with the North Korean refugees. It's not a burden it needs to shoulder on its own.
And our final question will go to Claire Hubbard in the second row.
Hi, my name is, Claire Hubbard. I'm interning at the Korea Economic Institute. And I have a question about your earlier comment on the black market for information with Chinese couriers. I recently read a book by Mike Kim, Escaping North Korea, and he's with the Crossing Borders Organization, and their two objectives are to either help defectors assimilate into the Korean Chinese community there or go back and into North Korea. And so I was wondering if you talked a little bit about North Korean defectors that choose to go back into North Korea in your book at all, or if you can you just tell us about what your thoughts are on that issue? Do you understand the question?
Yeah, did everybody hear she was asking about North Koreans who decide to go back to North Korea or who wish to stay and be assimilated into a Chinese society? I talked some about that. I call for China to offer temporary visas to North Koreans who wish to stay there and who are arguably productive members of Chinese society. That would be particularly the children of marriages between Chinese men and North Korean women, and in some cases the North Korean brides who are happy in their marriages with Chinese men. I don't know of too many people who want to go back to North Korea. My experience has been the same as Suzanne's, that every North Korean refugee I interviewed, I asked them what they wanted to do, and they wanted to go back to North Korea, but not now. They wanted to go back to a different North Korea at a time when North Korea had changed. Actually, I do know a few people who have gone back voluntarily, and this is a very controversial thing, but there are some who go back, who have become Christians and go back to North Korea to proselytize. And this is, of course, a very dangerous occupation, and if they're caught, they could be executed. There are also some North Koreans who have gone back as amateur journalists, and that also is very dangerous.
I guess we do have just 2 minutes left and one final question, the second row. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. What role, if any, has Harold Koh played in supporting your efforts?
I know of none, and maybe somebody else here knows something. He is probably the most prominent Korean-American, but I'm not aware of his interest. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he himself, as an attorney and law professor, has specialized in human rights. But I am unaware of any role he has played on this issue.
Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. I know there are many more good questions. Melanie's on a very tight schedule. She'll have a radio show at 1:55. She'll still be available for a few minutes to answer a couple of more questions and maybe for a very brief book signing as well. I would like to thank Grace Terzian, Vice President for Communications at Hudson, for her great work putting together this program. I would like to thank our colleagues at Hudson for hosting and executing this exceptional program, and our own interns at the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea for helping out today. And I would like to thank Melanie Kirkpatrick for her extraordinary contribution
to the work that North Korea human rights activists do.
To mention that film, that if anybody wants to
oh,
go,
yes.
that they were talking about?
And, well, one announcement. Our North Korean defectors were mentioning a film, 48M. It will show tonight at 6 p.m. At the Rayburn House Office Building, 2172 Rayburn House Office Building. That is 2172 Rayburn House, beginning at 6 p.m.